So first, many thanks to the organizers for the kind invitation. And since the title of this workshop was announced, I should somehow caution or remark that I'm not going to speak about quantum entropy, but I will close my talk with an open problem where I believe quantum entropies or quantum entropy method would be or might be the tool to solve and to attack that. So let me start with my talk and just give you a very brief application or an idea of an application where these type of models that I'm going to talk about appear. One application of such quantum Fokker-Planck models is in nanoelectronics to model and numerically simulate quantum semiconductor devices. And one of the prototype devices where this has been used by electrical engineers is a resonant tunneling diode. So what you see here is a schematics of such a structure. So a resonant tunneling diode is somewhat of a sandwiched structure of two different semiconductor materials. That's gallium arsenide and aluminum gallium arsenide. And because of these two different materials, the electrons that should travel along such a diode see such a step potential, and they typically have an energy that is below this barrier, so they can only cross through this barrier by sequential quantum mechanical tunneling. So the equation that has been used, or one of the models that has been used to simulate the electron flow through such a device, is based on Wigner functions. That's a quantum kinetic description of quantum mechanics. So the object that I'm going to talk about would be this Wigner function W. Do we have a pointer here?
Yeah.
I have it. Yeah. Thanks. So this is the object I'm going to talk about. The phase-based distribution, if you like, of a position variable x and velocity variable v. And I'm interested in the time evolution of this phase-based distribution w, given by this equation here on the first line. Time derivative here, the free... So that's the free transport term. Here is a term that involves the electrostatic potential V, where you may think of the step potential that I've shown you in the previous transparency. And then here on the right-hand side, we have some sort of a collision operator that takes into account the interaction between the electrons traveling along the diode and, let's say, the semiconductor material or the phonons of the semiconductor. And the model that I'm going to talk about here is such that this right-hand side has this elliptic form. So we have a Laplacian in velocity direction. We have a Laplacian in the position direction. Here's some mixed derivatives and a friction term. So let me just mention that the first two terms here of this operator Q would amount to a classical Fokker-Planck equation or classical Fokker-Planck term that is used in plasma physics, for example. Then the third and the fourth term are corrections that are needed to make this model quantum mechanically correct. One term that I didn't describe yet is this term where the potential enters. So that's the operator written down here. So what this operator does is you first Fourier transform in velocity direction, then you multiply with this difference of the potential, and then you inverse Fourier transform. So eta is the dual variable of V. So this operator is somewhat of a multiplication operator in Fourier space. The terms that we would typically be interested in would be the particle density. So that's the zero order moment of the Wigner function where you integrate over all velocities. And I should mention that I will only discuss here whole space problems where both the position and the velocity are in whole space. Although, of course, for the applications in nanoelectronics, you have a finite interval or finite domain, but I don't want to deal here with boundary conditions, which would be of such a form. So if you think in the one-dimensional model, here from 0 to L would be the interval of your device or of your diode, and since you have some characteristics of the transport, you would have to prescribe incoming electron distributions here for positive velocities and here for negative velocities. One more term that will be important for us is the coupling of the equation to the Poisson equation. So the potential that you see there in the equation, it consists of a step potential due to the different materials plus a self-consistent term where you couple or where you solve the Poisson equation with the particle density. So here's the outline of my talk. The first part of the talk, I will describe a joint work with Christoph Sparber, where we established a global in time solution to this Wigner-Fokker-Planck Poisson equation. And I will deal with this equation not on the level of Wigner functions, but on the level of density matrices. And in the second part of my talk, which is probably more in the spirit of this workshop, I will discuss steady states of the linear equation and the large time convergence with an exponential rate to that steady state. So as I said, from the analytical point of view, it's more convenient to not work with the Wigner function, although this is what engineers would usually use in their simulations, but with an equivalent description based on density matrices. So here on this slide, you just see the transformation from Wigner functions to density matrices. So here's the Wigner function being a real valued function in phase space. And by a Fourier transform and the shift of variables, you can transform that to another function, rho, which is given here. Since the Wigner function is real valued, this function rho inherits this symmetry, so if you just change first and second variable, you get the complex conjugate, so this rho will typically be complex valued. Now we take this rho, which we consider as the kernel of a density matrix, and build an integral operator with this kernel. And again, because of this symmetry, this integral operator, which I now denote with this calligraphic rho, will be our density matrix. And in quantum physics, this is one of the typical descriptions for mixed quantum systems. So some of the hypotheses that one puts on describing a physically reasonable quantum system would be that you describe that by a positive operator, which is trace class, let's say trace class on F2, and which has trace equal to 1. Trace equal to 1 means, or the trace of this operator is nothing else but the total mass of that system. So you normalize the mass of that system. I said that for the nonlinear evolution equation, I will need the particle density, the physical density of my electrons just as a function of position. Now the question is how to translate all these variables to the density. So by just going through the transformations from the previous slide, you can see that the particle density can be obtained from the kernel of this density matrix evaluated at the diagonal. First two entries have to be the same. And well, think typically of this kernel as being an L2 function. So then this expression would just be very formal if you evaluate an L2 function at the diagonal. However, if you know that the operator, the density matrix operator, is trace class, you can check that this is a rigorous definition. And you easily have that inequality that the particle density in L1 is bounded by the trace class norm of this operator. And as we shall see, this trace class norm, or the mass of the system, is constant under time evolution. So we have a quantum system with a Hamiltonian part, plus a dissipative part due to the interaction with, let's say, the phonons of the crystal lattice, but we have conservation of mass. The second macroscopic quantity that I shall use is the kinetic energy of such a density matrix, which is defined as the trace of Laplacian acting on the density matrix operator. If this operator is positive, then you can easily check that this kinetic energy is also non-negative. I will need that because somehow the analysis will take place in this, let's say, kinetic energy space. So I consider density matrices which have a finite kinetic energy. And the norm that I will use is this norm, so I somehow split or take the square root of this Laplacian and put that in this symmetric form. And the norm that you see here, so that's trace class norm, is somehow the operator analog of an H1 norm. The reason why this is convenient is that if you work in this kinetic energy space, then you can bound also higher LP norms of the particle density. Up there we only had the L1 norm. If you have a finite kinetic energy, you can go up to higher LP norms. This inequality here, which is of some Lipp-Thierring type, is essentially some collective Sobolev inequality. So in the beginning, I showed you the evolution equation on the Wigner level. So now we've translated the description of the states, of the physical states at each point in time. Next, we have to translate the time evolution. So here is again the evolution equation for the Wigner function. And now I specify what this, let's say, collision operator is. So you have all these derivatives in x and in velocity direction with various parameters. And the parameters have to be such that this inequality is satisfied, which is a condition for this equation to be quantum mechanically correct. Just one remark here. Alpha, beta, and gamma are the second order derivatives in this system. So this difference is strictly positive. So this condition means the equation or the right hand side is elliptic, uniformly elliptic, and actually more than that. So just to recall what I did earlier, I started with a description of the Wigner of my quantum system by Wigner functions. I translated that to density matrix functions, which I interpret as a kernel of an integral operator. Then I translate that to the integral operator. Now, with these two steps, I also have to translate the evolution equation. So just by using the transformations, you write down an equation for this L2 function of the density matrix. So here you have the Hamiltonian of the system, which is the Laplacian plus some electrostatic potential, which is time dependent. And all the other terms, which I will not go through in detail, are then what comes out of all these derivatives by going through this transformation. The only aspect that I want to call your attention to is all these terms that appear here are just quadratic in either x and the derivative. And this is aspect that I'll need later on in my analysis. So second step of the transformation is to go or to write down an evolution equation not for the kernel but for the corresponding integral operator. So here I'm a bit abstract, but I'll get more precise in a minute. So it consists of a Hamiltonian part, so that's the commutator of the Hamiltonian with the density matrix. This is what you obtain from here. And then you have this dissipative part with some operators L that I didn't specify yet, but that I'll explain in a minute. So the structure of my linear evolution equation, let's forget about the potential for the moment, or let's assume it's given, is the time evolution of my density matrix operator consists of a Hamiltonian part, which would be equivalent to a Schrödinger equation, if you like, plus the dissipative part where all the collisional terms enter. And by the standard or by standard assumptions on open quantum systems, that means on dissipative quantum systems, the dissipative part has to have this particular structure called the Lindblad structure. So the dissipative term must be in that form that there are operators LK such that you can write it like this. This looks a bit abstract at the moment, and just to give you an idea or a feeling of what these operators might be, let's go through some examples. So one example would be, just take one Lindblad operator L, which is just the multiplication by the position variable. So if you go through all these transformations, if you do them backwards in some sense, you see that the corresponding dissipative operator would be a Laplacian in velocity direction on the kinetic level. Second example, if you just have one operator which is a derivative, then this corresponds to an X Laplacian on the kinetic level. So the question is, for this model that I wrote down in the beginning, for this quantum Fokker-Planck model, what would be the corresponding operators? The answer is, they're all linear combinations between these two operators here, and you have up to 2 times space dimension of this operator. I don't write down the constants because that's not so interesting for us. So here's the equation again. Evolution, the linear evolution equation for the density matrix operator, Hamiltonian part, dissipative part in Lindblad form. This Hamiltonian involves the potential, which is obtained from solving this Poisson equation. So here, this V, the potential, depends on the density matrix. So here, in this term, you have a quadratic nonlinearity, which causes the analytical problems. So the result that we obtained with Christoph Schwabe some years ago is, for this nonlinear evolution equation, you have a global in time trace preserving solution, and it has finite energy. And the total mass, which is the trace of the density matrix, is preserved. And let me now just briefly sketch the proof of that. So the proof will be in 3 steps. So the first step is, assume you know the potential here. Then you have to construct the solution of the linear evolution equation. You want to come up with an evolution semigroup, both in the space of trace class operators and in the space of these density matrices that have finite kinetic energy. Second step, you have this nonlinear potential term, which we will consider as a nonlinear perturbation. There you use standard arguments from PDE theory. So as we shall see, this is a local Lipschitz perturbation, and then you get a local in time solution. Then last step, you have a priori estimates on physical quantities, that is total mass, which is conserved, kinetic energy, which doesn't flow up, which tells you the solution is global. So I will just go into some details of the most difficult part of that proof, which surprisingly is the first part, to solve the linear equation. Nonlinearity is standard PDE tools. But let me describe what are the problems in the linear case. So as I said, the linear equation has this structure. This calligraphic L is the generator of our semigroup, or the generator to be. Here is the Hamiltonian part. This is the dissipative part. Now we are in the just purely linear regime. We threw out this time-dependent potential. So for such equations, which are the prototype structure of open quantum systems, there's an old theory of Davis who gave a constructive way of finding a solution semigroup to that problem. And in his theory, that's called the minimal solution of this problem, or of this equation. But there are several problems to that. And I will go through these problems, and these 3 problems that I will state, they're all connected to each other. So on one hand, the solution that he constructed might not give you a unique semigroup. There can be other semigroups or solutions that you can construct. That's related to the problem that the domain of this generator that you use might be, in some sense, too small. And I will come back to that. And another way how you see the trouble that you will run into is that formally this equation should have mass conservation. But when you construct this minimal solution, you check that it actually loses mass. And it might tend to zero mass in finite time. And these are not just hypothetical problems. You can write down equations of this structure when you actually run into these problems. So they indeed can happen in the linear case. So you have to check that this does not happen. And one way I will prove that this, in fact, does not happen, but showing that this minimal solution is somehow the good solution, is by showing that the domain of the generator, or actually the closure of the generator, is in some sense big enough. And I'll now make a small detour into, let's say, operator theory to give you an idea of the involved problems, or to give you an idea that these type of problems and also the loss of mass is somewhat natural, or a natural problem that can appear here. Let me start with this very simple lemma. Think just of functions in L2, and I'm considering an operator which is a quadratic polynomial of x and the derivative. And for this operator, I will compare two realizations, somehow this the minimal and the maximal realization of the operator. So what I mean with that is define this operator in the first place on C0 infinity, which I will consider as the minimal realization, the smallest reasonable domain. Then the statement of this lemma is, if you close this operator, you get the maximal extension of this operator, in the sense that then the domain of the closure is all L2 functions such that you map still into L2. This is the maximal possible domain. This lemma sounds very harmless. The proof is straightforward. So just take some element of this larger domain, and you want to approximate it in the graph norm by elements of C0 infinity. You do that with a modification at the cutoff, just the way you would expect it. Straightforward, but quite tedious because of all these terms involved in the quadratic. One caution in this lemma, while it is easy for a quadratic polynomial, it's absolutely wrong for higher order polynomials. Let me give you some examples, because this lemma is somehow the core of the problems that I want to avoid. Let's think of a Schrödinger equation with a Hamiltonian being minus the Laplacian minus the harmonic oscillator potential. So that's a textbook example, and it's well known. If you consider this operator on C0 infinity, this operator is essentially self-adjoint. So if you close that, you have a nice evolution group for the Schrödinger equation with nice, mass-preserving and so forth, and unitary. Second example, again, a textbook example. Look at this Hamiltonian with minus the quartic potential, now in one space dimension. It is well known that this operator is not essentially self-adjoint on C0 infinity. With the plus sign, so a quartic growing potential, a confinement potential, it would be essentially self-adjoint. So what would be the problem of an evolution here? Well, think first of classical mechanics, just particle mechanics. Assume you have a potential, a quartic potential, that falls off. Then you have particles that run to infinity in finite time. So in the classical dynamics, you lose mass in finite time, and so you do in quantum mechanics. So in the Schrödinger equation here, you would lose mass in finite time. So you don't have an evolution group even for that Schrödinger equation. And so that is closely linked to the problem that I started. So formally, of course, even that would be nice, but rigorously not. Let me recall the problem that I have. I want to show that for my quantum evolution equation, the domain of the closure of the generator is big enough. And now here is an operator version of this quadratic polynomial lemma that I stated before. Same spirit, just notationally a bit more complex. L of rho, let this be a quadratic polynomial again, quadratic in x and the derivative. So, for example, it will be our quantum Fokker-Planck operator, which is exactly of that structure, just quadratic terms. Then the closure of the minimal realization is the maximum realization. Now everything considered in the space of trace class operator. Here I will not be very precise what by smallest domain is, but think of a dense subset of trace class operators that have C0 infinity kernels. I will skip the details because that is a bit technical. Proof is very similar in the spirit to the proof before. So once you have that, you know that the domain of the closure of your generator is as large as can be, so you don't run into these problems of losing mass. So just to go back to the sketch of the proof, this allows us to construct the solution to the linear equation here. And then, as I mentioned, standard PDE arguments tell you that the solution exists for all time. I will just go here to the a priori estimates. So the two a priori estimates that you use is, on one hand, you have conservation of mass, as I described, and on the other hand, you have a balance equation for the total energy, which is kinetic energy plus potential energy. This tells you the solution exists globally. Second part of my talk. So now I come back to linear quantum Fokker-Planck equations with a confinement potential, and I'm concerned with steady states and the convergence to steady states. So I start, so the question or the equation I want to consider here first, the evolution equation, is this model equation here. Here's the free streaming part of the Wigner equation. I start again with the Wigner formalism and then reformulate that. As I assume that my potential has a quadratic confinement potential, if you plug that into the Wigner equation, this will give you this term. And then you have these diffusion terms in the Wigner equation. I assume that my given potential, now time independent, consists of a confinement potential plus a small perturbation with the perturbation parameter lambda. And this perturbation part will remain in this Wigner operator here. So before describing how to deal with this perturbed potential, let me recall a theorem that was given in this paper of Sparber, Carrillo, Dolbo, and Markovic some years ago. So first in the case for lambda equals zero, so this means purely quadratic finite potential. So in this case, we skip this term here, and what we have here is a nice parabolic equation, only parabolic. For this case, you have a nice Green's function to write down explicitly the solution of the linear equation. And from this form, you can also write down explicitly the steady state of this equation. It has this Gaussian structure, so if I make the right normalization, my unique steady state is of the form exponential with minus this quadratic polynomial. It's non-isotropic, so you have different coefficients in position and velocity direction. Moreover, in this paper, it was shown that the solution converges to this steady state with an exponential rate in various norms. For example, in L1 or in this weighted L2 norm, it's weighted by the inverse of the steady state, since the steady state is Gaussian, so you have a nice inverse. Also, in relative entropy, if you like. Let me just mention a few aspects of how to prove this question of convergence to the steady state here. So this was done in that paper using tools of the entropy method. So the key would be to consider it in this weighted L2 space and to work with a quadratic relative entropy, which is essentially a weighted L2 norm. So in this space, take the generator of your evolution equation. Remember this term on the right, on the left-hand side was gone. Split that into its symmetric and anti-symmetric part. This splitting has to be done with respect to the inner product of this space here. Then you compute what the symmetric part is. The symmetric part of this lengthy generator here is this operator here, which is which gives rise to just a drift diffusion equation. So here you have the diffusion term, diffusion now both in position and velocity, and here you have a drift term with the potential A being just this quadratic polynomial. For such drift diffusion equations, there is a well-known theory that tells you essentially everything about the convergence to the steady state, particularly for potentials A that have this nice form here, since this is a quadratic potential which is uniformly convex in both x and v. This potential satisfies the so-called Bakri-Emery condition, which means that the Hessian of the potential, Hessian now considered with respect to both variables, so in phase space, is uniformly bounded below, uniformly in x and v, well, since this is this quadratic polynomial. And once you have this convexity condition, then you know that this operator that is given here has a spectral gap that can be computed here explicitly. Also, this operator gives rise to logarithmic Sobolev inequality, or if you like, this steady state measure gives rise to logarithmic Sobolev inequality. And from that, you can deduce exponential convergence with an explicit rate to the steady state. And that's the background of this line here. I have 10 more minutes or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So now let me come back to the problem with the perturbation potential. So here is the perturbation term, and think of this potential V0 as a smooth potential and lambda a small perturbation parameter. And this is now joint work with Irene Gamber, Maria Guldani, and Christoph. So here's we have the following theorem. Let's assume that the initial function is again in this weight, in this space calligraphic H, which was this weighted L2 space. And the weight that appears here is the steady state, or the inverse of the steady state, of the unperturbed evolution equation. Unperturbed means this term is gone. So just the quadratic confinement. Then we have two statements. First of all, this Wigner-Fokker-Planck equation, which is written here, the linear equation, has a unique normalized steady state. The steady state of the perturbed problem I call W infinity with the tilde. Plus, the solution converges to the steady state with an exponential rate. And this is measured again in this weighted L2 space, weighted with the steady state of the unperturbed problem. Let me just give you a brief idea of the proof. So to prove that there is a unique normalized steady state, we use a fixed point argument. So the operator L is here, the right-hand side, the Wigner-Fokker-Planck operator. W infinity was the steady state of just this term. So when putting this in, L on W infinity disappears, because that's in the kernel. So I rewrite my steady state equation as this equation. And I use this in a natural way as an iteration. So plug in here your old Wn, and then compute a new Wn plus 1 from this equation. And this has to be considered in the orthogonal of the steady state. Orthogonal of the steady state to the unperturbed problem. Because L would have a kernel, non-trivial kernel, so otherwise you wouldn't be able to solve that. So the idea why this iteration is contractive is essentially this operator L has a spectral gap. So if you remove the kernel, then its spectrum is strictly away from zero, and then this helps you to compensate this operator here, provided lambda is small. So this is the background of what you do here. Second issue here is exponential convergence to the steady state. So here, this term, this weighted L2 norm, turns out to be a Lyapunov functional, again in the orthogonal complement of the steady state. Just one remark here concerning this Lyapunov functional. Here the W tilde is the steady state of your perturbed problem. And in this space H, the weighted L2 space, you have the steady state of the unperturbed problem. So you have two steady states in the construction of this Lyapunov functional. Again, the idea is here the spectral gap of the symmetric part of your generator compensates this perturbation. So there is one more question that is left open by this theorem. Here we know that we have a unique, a nice steady state on the level of Wigner functions. Question is, is this Wigner function that we get and that lives in this weighted L2 space a physical steady state? Physical steady state means, on the level of density matrices, is this, on one hand, positive operator, and second, is a trace price operator? Of course, these are two questions that you cannot answer on the level of Wigner functions. For that, you have to come back to density matrices. And that's what I'm going to answer here. So on the level of density matrices, this is now again my linear evolution equation. Remember the Hamiltonian part, the dissipative part. Here the Hamiltonian has this form, Laplacian quadratic potential, perturbation potential, plus some correction term. And I start with an initial function, initial density matrix, which is trace class and which has mass 1. So the theorem that we have is, again, for a small perturbation parameter, this equation has a unique normalized steady state. It's positive, and it is trace class. It converges with an exponential rate to that steady state in the Hilbert-Schmidt norm, which is equivalent to the L2 norm for Wigner functions. Plus, we have convergence to the steady state in the stronger norm, the trace class norm, but without a rate. So here's my last transparency, and let me just sketch the proof of that. So here are the three statements again, and I'll start with the simplest part, which is the proof of part B. This is essentially trivial. Remember what we did before? Was we were dealing with the Wigner function in a weighted L2 space. And the weight is such that it grows at infinity. So this weighted L2 norm is much stronger than the unweighted L2 norm. So this inequality is trivial. The unweighted L2 norm for the Wigner function is equivalent to the L2 norm of the density matrix kernel. And this one, again, is equivalent to the Hilbert-Schmidt norm of the density matrix operator. So this convergence in the Hilbert-Schmidt norm is a simple consequence of the corresponding convergence of the Wigner function in a weighted L2 space. That's easy. More interesting is, why is the steady state a positive operator and why is it trace class? Well, let's go back to the first part of my talk where I established a solution to the evolution problem. The key part was the evolution, the linear evolution problem. And the result that we had there is, for the linear quantum Fokker-Planck equation, we have a unique solution, global in time, from 0 to infinity, in the space of trace class operators. And actually, it's in the positive cone of trace cause operators. So, since the whole evolution trajectory stays in the positive cone, and since we have convergence in Hilbert-Schmidt to a steady state, then also the steady state must be a positive operator because of this result that we had already before. Moreover, we proved in the first part of my talk that the solution is mass-preserving, which means since it is a positive solution, a positive operator, that the trace class norm, or the trace, is always equal to 1 along the whole trajectory. Since it converges to a steady state, then also the norm of the steady state will be 1. And by using Alaoglu's theorem, you know that the steady state must also be in the space of trace class operators. Because for trace class operators, you have a pre-dual, so this is what you get out of that. The last statement that we have here. We also have convergence to the steady state, not only in Hilbert-Schmidt, but also in the trace class norm. How do we get that? Well, okay, no problem. So from this line B, which is convergence in Hilbert-Schmidt, this tells us that we also have convergence in the strong operator topology, which is much less. We know from this line here that the trajectory always has a constant trace class norm, and that the limit also has trace class norm 1. So we have on one hand convergence in the strong operator topology to the limit, and we have convergence of the trace class norm. And then Grimm's theorem tells you that these two imply convergence in the trace class norm. So the solution converges in the trace class norm to the steady state. However, in this theorem, you would lose the information about this exponential rate. This is an open problem, how to get exponential convergence to the steady state. And one hope, would be that one could come up with something like a quantum entropy method in order to estimate the difference of the solution to the steady state in the trace class norm by the relative quantum entropy, which is an existing inequality, and to work on the exponential decay of the relative quantum entropy such a quantum entropy method. There are some ideas how to start that, and that has been started for finite dimensional problems. There are some examples where this already works, but the general setting is here is still far away. So thank you very much for your attention.